Hello and welcome to the Decode Podcast. I'm Matt Landers and I'm joined with my co-hosts again, Will Johnson. Welcome.
Hey.
And Kellen Mace.
Hello, hello.
And we are the DevRel team from WP Engine. So if you want to join our community, I'll throw this out there. So you can find us. If you want to join our community, give us feedback and just talk about all things front-end development, headless WordPress. You can find us at developers.wpengine.com, which is where you can also find our Discord channel. So you can get in and interact with us and the community. And then there's this podcast that launches every Monday, as well as live coding that we do every Friday at 1 p.m. Central. So definitely come and find us wherever we are. And we post all of our content on the developer site. All right. So today we have a fun topic. Surprisingly, we haven't talked about this yet, but we're going to talk about headless WordPress in general, why, when, how you should use it. When it's right for you. But first, we're going to talk about a discussion that was had at the Jamstack conference in 2020 between two Matts, another Matt, not me, Matt Billman, who is the CEO and co-founder, I think, of Netlify, and Matt Mullenweg, who is the founder, co-founder, developer, and initially of WordPress. So it was a Jamstack conference. They invited Matt Mullenweg to the conference to have like a fireside chat between those two, and it got kind of weird. So if you haven't seen it, I would definitely go check it out, but it got weird because I don't really know why. I don't know why it had to get weird. What do you guys think?
It got heated. It got heated.
As heated as you can get between two nerds, I guess, right?
Does the recording exist?
The recording does exist.
I just read all the articles, I think, the write-ups about it.
Yeah, and I was watching it live, and I remember being like, this is bizarre. I don't know what's going on right now. But let's just get to the crux of the situation. So the Jamstack term, which I'm not crazy about that term, just because it doesn't mean a whole lot to me, because I've been coding with JavaScript markup and APIs for a decade. I know that they've kind of they've changed what that term means and they're a little more fluid with it now. But it's more of a marketing term to say that you're going to build sites in this atomic way. The main thing for Netlify is that you have atomic deployments, right? Like there's stateless deployments when you can deploy them at any time, anywhere, and you get the same result. That's kind of the idea with it. And it has less to do with really how you build the site as long as it runs on their platform. So this whole conference was about the Jamstack, like how people are building sites, static site generators, server-side rendering, all of this stuff. And then they had Matt Mullenweg on there to talk about WordPress, and it kind of became this like battle between WordPress and Jamstack, although I don't know if that was intentional or not. Like if that's
I don't
how
think,
they,
you know, I was there too and listening to it. I do not think that that was the intent, that the conversation went that direction. And then there was some stuff online posted afterwards that kind of fed into it. But I don't think that was the intent.
Yeah, I would hope not. I think the intent from Netlify's perspective was, hey, you can do WordPress with the Jamstack. Like a lot of people are using WordPress with Jamstack. And I think that's where I thought it was going to go, is like, how do these two things play well together? Which is what we do, which is why I was excited to see this talk. And then it turned into like WordPress versus Jamstack, which I don't think personally, I don't think that it has to be a versus argument.
I really think it's kind of like an apples and oranges comparison, because there are valid reasons to use both. We'll obviously get into it in this podcast, but there are valid reasons to use a traditional monolithic WordPress or some other monolithic CMS. There are valid reasons to use the Jamstack and decoupled CMSs.
Right. Yeah, let's go over some of the arguments that Matt Mullenweg was making against the Jamstack. I think that was where most of the contention was, is that he was making the argument that you don't need to do all this static site generation. We've been using CDNs for years. So, I guess let's dig into the CDN part first. Like, his argument was that, yes, WordPress needs to do all this work and it needs to render HTML at the time of the request, but we can push that generated response to a CDN and cache it essentially. And then it's basically the same thing at that point. So if you're generating a static file and pushing it to a CDN, or you're generating a response and saving that to a CDN, what's the actual difference? Like, we've been doing that for decades, right?
Sure. One thing I'd point out is that a CDN definitely helps you scale a site, but if your site is small, you may not even need a CDN if you're using the Jamstack. If you're using WordPress, you're almost certainly going to want a CDN, because without it, WordPress is not very, it doesn't perform very well.
Right. Yeah, like if you're using the Jamstack, and I really hate saying that word, but if you're building with a modern framework, let's say that, you can usually deploy your site wherever your users are. You don't necessarily have to push it all to a CDN, because you can do this horizontal deployment to different geographies, and you're good to go. You can cache whatever API responses you need, or if you have a database that can scale or replicate, like Cockroach or something, you can use that. There's so many different options in that scenario. And then when you go with WordPress, you know, you still have to have WordPress hosted in one geography, but you can cache those responses, and then the front end can handle that wherever you are. But now it's become so easy just to add a CDN on front. You don't really have to think about it. Like, you don't even have to push your files anywhere anymore. If you're using like Cloudflare, it'll just do it based on that first request.
And then you have hosting providers that just do it for you. So you don't even, there's almost no configuration necessary. You deploy your site and you don't even think about a CDN, and it's just there and it works.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of the debate was about the CDN, but honestly, I mean, I've been building these sites for a long time and I never really think about the CDN. It's not something I have to put a lot of effort into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I believe like one of the reasons for Netlify's popularity has been, and just the Jamstack like methodology in general, is the immediate invalidation of CDN assets. Is that true? Is it your understanding, you guys? Because if you have a traditional WordPress site, I think the caching of your assets on a CDN is always time-based, right? So users will get continue getting that asset until it's expired, at which point a new resource will be generated. But some, you know, systems like Netlify have it so that, you know, when new assets are available, the old ones are immediately invalidated. So the very next request that comes in, they're getting the new one. So I think there's some, you know, some gains there to getting your content.
Yeah, I don't know if it's immediate validation or if it's just that when you do a rebuild, you end up with different file names. So that's right. How you end up busting the cache.
Right.
But different CDN providers have different ways to purge the cache. So like Cloudflare's is pretty granular. You can go just make an API call and like just invalidate any particular route. But some of them are like all or nothing. So it's like you got to invalidate it all at once. It just depends on your CDN provider at that point.
I think there are plugins in WordPress that help you do this too. So if you're on a traditional WordPress site, and you want to publish a post, it can make an API call to Cloudflare and invalidate the cache for you.
Yeah, Cloudflare actually provides a plugin to do just that. So it pays attention to whenever data is changing, and it will go out and invalidate the CDN cache. So I think at the end of the day, Mullenweg's point was, hey, we've been caching WordPress and running large enterprise, high traffic sites on WordPress for decades. Like you're not solving any problem that we haven't already solved, is his point. And then the point that he made based on that is saying, not only are you not solving a problem that's not already solved, but you're introducing new problems, which are the fact that now you've got a regression from the content publisher's point of view. and that they no longer have the control and the user experience that they had before whenever you go headless. Since WordPress isn't responsible for rendering the site, the marketer can't go in and make layout changes or add new pages very easily, or there's a lot of, you just lose a lot of the things they were able to do, or like change a theme, add a plugin, like a lot of those things just don't work. So Mullenweg's point is, why would we do this? Why would we regress in that area? And I think that's probably the most fair point that he made, and probably the one that I would say that most people need to think about whenever they are going to go headless is it okay? Does your workflow, your content publication workflow, and the way that you're producing content and getting it out there, is it compatible with a headless environment where those content producers and publishers don't have as much control and they're more reliant on a developer to make changes for them?
Yep. Yeah. I would say just because headless WordPress doesn't have that at this moment doesn't mean it never will. You know, I think those changes are coming. There's always a balance there. You know, a lot of people are drawn to WordPress because they can make those changes without themselves. It's kind of like the OG no code solution for websites, you know, where you can, if you want an image slider to appear on a certain point, you know, you can search the plugin repository, install a slider plugin, place that on a particular page, load it up with images, you know, and that's it, all without any code intervention. That's cool. There's a lot of power there if I'm a small business owner and doesn't want to pay for custom development and so on. However, it can be the Wild West if you're a large, you know, content publishing company. You may not want that level of, you know, control and people just putting whatever elements wherever the heck they want on your site. You may want it to be more locked down where, you know, we have a strict, you know, way that we do all of our layouts, and, you know, the content that you write needs to be injected in this exact spot on the site. So I'd say that can be a pro and a negative. And also back to my other point that I think that's coming, those kinds of solutions to headless.
Yeah, I like your point that headless WordPress or headless CMSs in the Jamstack in general may not be at the point where a marketer can come in and just have full control of their site like they can on WordPress if they want it. But it's coming. We're kind of converging towards that point. Another point I'll make there is, like, even coming from myself is, you know, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of WordPress. I'm also not necessarily a fan of the term Jamstack. But if I want to, if I'm sitting here right now and I say I want to build a site as quickly as possible, and I don't, you know, like, I'm not a developer. I don't necessarily know how to do certain things. I can register a domain name, get my site running, get everything set up in a number of hours, choose a theme, choose all my different, you know, content types and posts, have some default content up there, and have all that ready like before the end of the day today. If I want to, if I'm using traditional WordPress, I just have no ability to do that with any Jamstack product that I'm aware of right now. And that is probably coming in the future, but as of right now, you have to be a developer, not just any developer. You have to understand whatever Jamstack product you're going to work with and whatever hosting platform you're going to be hosting on in order to deploy a Jamstack site.
Yeah, that's a good point. My wife has a site and she set it all up herself. And if she came to me and said, should I make this headless? I would absolutely say no. Because I don't want to be the developer on the hook to go fix her site whenever there's a problem. Like, she got a WP Engine account. She created the site. She found the theme that she wanted, bought it, downloaded it, installed it. I haven't touched the thing. And she's not a developer. Can she mess around with HTML and CSS? Sure. But, you know, it's nice just for her to be able to go do that. And that's a great example of something where, you know, stay traditional WordPress. So that's great. She is the solo maintainer of this site. She's adding the content to it, the pictures, whatever. And there's no reason for that to be a headless site. I think most sites fall in that category.
Yeah. your wife doesn't want to have to depend on a developer or you to be changing things on her site, right? That's, she wants to be able to go in and say, oh, you know, I don't like the look of this. I want to change that. And her site is such that she can do that herself. In a Jamstack scenario, if she spent a ton of, or you probably spend a ton of time writing this site up, maybe she does have some configurability, but it would certainly not be near as close to what you can get out of WordPress right now.
Right. I think when you decide to go headless, you know, there are some things that you're trying to unlock there. For one, I would say that you probably are thinking about scalability and security, right? Really top of mind. The other one is, like, if you're a developer creating the site, you might be doing it because you enjoy writing sites with modern frameworks. You don't want to use PHP, but you want to have this back-end content publishing engine like WordPress. And that's a really good reason. All of those are great reasons to go headless. I think that if you're in an enterprise scenario where you're integrating with a lot of third-party services, that's a great reason to go headless. I've seen plenty of WordPress installs that get pretty messy once you have a lot of plugins in there, relying on a lot of services. There was one time with our agency where somebody came to us and they had a WordPress site. And one of the reasons they wanted us to work on it was that all of a sudden their site had ads all over it. And they didn't know why. You know, they had all that control. They had installed a rogue plugin and it started injecting some Google ads all over, and so they could collect some revenue. That kind of stuff happens all the time. So even when you are in a traditional WordPress environment in an enterprise, a lot of times that stuff's locked down anyways. Like, no one, other random people can't just install plugins. Random people can't just create pages and change layouts. So in an enterprise scenario, I think the difference between headless and traditional becomes more blurred because you don't have the capabilities that you had in WordPress out of the box as a user of that site anyways. So when you go headless, you actually have more control over the front end as the developer. You get to decide everything about how that thing's going to render, how it's going to be deployed, how it's going to scale, which I find, you know, obviously I'm a proponent of headless, which I find really great. So you guys have any comments on that?
Yeah, I view it as, you know, as modernizing your front end stack and letting you be able to leverage, you know, a lot of the advancements that the web has made over the last, you know, few years. Most traditional WordPress sites, in my experience, don't do a lot of things that today would be considered best practices, like, you know, lazy loading images, you know, so if the user is about to scroll an image into view, at that point you swap out some low res placeholder image with the full res image instead of trying to load all images as soon as the page loads. I mentioned this on our previous podcast episode as well, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, it's definitely possible in traditional WordPress, but just requires, like, you know, plugins and targeting your images and worrying about where, you know, I have to create low res placeholder images and write them to the file system somewhere and make sure that those are loaded in. And a lot of that kind of work is done for you with a lot of these frameworks. There, you get instantaneous route transitions with these frameworks. Matt mentioned scalability, security, and so on. Another big one in my mind is just these build tools that are very smart, so to speak, and know exactly the data that's used for every route and can build you know, JavaScript and CSS bundles that are tailored to just what that route needs, you know, so you can leverage things like code splitting and tree shaking to get very small bundles, which will make your Lighthouse scores go up. All of these advancements, I feel like you benefit from when you go headless. And I know several people in the community who think that once headless gets to a point where users do have that level of configurability, you know, if they can do things like controlling the layout, hit save, and then have those changes actually reflected in the headless application, it's over. You know, then it's like you run out of reasons to use a traditional monolithic WordPress stack and have a lot more reasons to go headless. One last thing that we haven't mentioned is the backend. If you go for a headless architecture where your backend is serving up just JSON data, all of a sudden you can leverage that in more places than just the web, right? So there are businesses out there that that have a web client where they display their products or posts or whatever their content is, but then they also have iOS and Android applications or a desktop app or whatever. And when your backend is this, you know, kind of agnostic API that just serves up JSON data, all of a sudden you can leverage that on a number of different clients as well. So that kind of frees you up. You know, maybe you're a small business that has grown over the years, and now you need more than just a website. You know, if your backend is that JSON API, makes it very, I won't say very easy, but you know, easier to repurpose for multiple platforms too.
Yeah. So something you're touching on there is brings up a point I wanted to make. And we kind of already talked about this, but Jamstack, I view Jamstack as a buzzword, a brilliant marketing term used to describe websites that are, you know, mostly JavaScript that are served through a CDN and might be, you know, mostly static with some dynamic pages. And you're talking about, you know, REST or some JSON API, right? And I think it's important to say that while the term Jamstack has been around since maybe 2016 sometime, the concept of APIs and you know, front-end JavaScript sites, even single-page apps, is much older than that, right? Having a three-tier architecture is something that was talked about in the early 2000s, and more N-tier architecture after that. Single-page apps have been around since before 2010. All these things are, you know, Jamstack was created to kind of put all those things together into one term. But this isn't something that's new to the web, right? This is stuff, this is how people have been building applications for a very long time already.
Right, and it's how I've been doing it. Mm-hmm. I can't remember a time when I was coding last 20 years where I didn't use APIs. So it's been like, it was really strange to see that.
So I think it's always been, if you're trying to compare Jamstack or what Jamstack represents to WordPress, it's always been an apples to oranges thing. It's like, well, what are you trying to do? Are you a marketer who wants to have a small marketing site? Or are you an enterprise or some business that has a bunch of different avenues where they need to get their data and they need an API to drive that, right? And that's the real thing that Jamstack enables. It starts enabling this like more API driven, but still very fast and very reliable websites.
Right. I do think that it's been good to kind of highlight that development methodology, especially the pre-rendering part. I think that's what it really was about in the beginning, is pre-rendering your pages and getting that content. There's also this misnomer that I want to make clear too, that static in the Jamstack world or with modern frameworks is not the same as static from the late 90s, early 2000s. Like when I think of static, when this first started happening, I was like, static, how is that ever going to, that doesn't make any sense. Like, come on, we're past that.
But it's not static
in the sense of an HTML file and some CSS, and then that's your site. Like, it's still dynamic experiences. It's just that part of the site ends up being statically generated so that, you know, search engines can crawl it. You can get that content immediately displayed to you without waiting for JavaScript to go load it up into the window. So in a traditional spa, that first hit, you'll see like kind of like a blank screen sometimes before the framework has had a chance to compile everything and render it into the HTML element. I will say that in today's world with our browsers and how much power we have on our phones, that's pretty minimal. I've written a lot of sites that are true spas and you would have no idea, and they're blazingly fast, just as fast as these other ones.
Yeah, I'd say the only problem with them is you have to jump through hoops to get search engines to work properly with them and all that. But if you're just a user of the application going to one of these sites that is a client-side rendered single page app, you can get a very fast experience. Server-side rendering or static site generation is definitely, you know, moves the needle a little bit further, but it's not like it's the difference between having a WordPress site just not served through a CDN and having one served through a CDN. That's a much larger difference than this static site generation versus client-side rendering.
Right. There's very little difference, pretty much imperceivable. You might notice that flash initially, but then when you're navigating on the site, it's instantaneous. Like it's actually, I mean, everybody's used to it now, but when we were doing it, you know, 7 years ago, it was crazy to show people a site written in a SPA versus a traditionally server rendered site.
And one comparison I've seen that I think is kind of helpful is comparing Jamstack apps to mobile applications that you might have on your phone. So this would be, if you picture this, you know, somebody installing an app from the App Store, that would be the same as somebody hitting your URL and downloading that, you know, bundle from the nearest CDN. So what they're getting there is like the app shell, so to speak. So it might be like the header and the footer and other assets that are the same for every user, but then any user specific content, then that would be fetched on demand, right? So they would know, oh, this person's logged in, so we're going to hit our server in the background and fetch this person's particular purchase history or whatever it may be. And then they load that into the view. And there may also be some on-device caching, you know, they can do to remember that, load it up more quickly next time. So on the web, that would be, for us, that would be akin to something like local storage or IndexedDB or whatever. So that's helpful for me to think about. It's a similar model, you know, so when you launch that app on your phone, it loads up instantaneously, right, where you get the header and footer or whatever, and then anything customizable or anything, you know, any personalized data that can be fetched on the fly. In our last episode, we blurred the lines a bit and said, you know, you can add server-side rendering into the mix where even the personalized data you're getting from the server, and that's, you know, I think that's where the Jamstack term is starting to be stretched to include some of those things. But in the original, you know, the original concept of it, I think it was very similar to mobile apps.
Right. Yeah, I think the drive back to server-side rendered stuff is pretty interesting to me. Because we went away from that intentionally, like when these frameworks came out. We're like, hey, the browser has all this power. Why aren't we making our servers do all this work when people have all this power on the browser, on their phones, and everywhere else? Let's let all that code run there. So it was all about like offloading compute at that point. And then we ran into this issue of, you know, SEO and all the issues that that generated, because at the time, search engines, except for Google, weren't really running JavaScript. So yeah, Google might be able to index your SPA, but then other tools out there like the Alexa ranking and those kind of things weren't running JavaScript whenever they pulled it down. So it affected some of your SEO, not necessarily with Google rankings, but with other services. And then we suddenly ended up back in this server-side rendered or statically generated model.
Yeah, although I'd say we're still offloading. Like Kellen said, in the new model of static sites, you basically, if you're building your site correctly, a large portion of your site is statically generated. It might live in some, you know, like surf through CDN might live in S3 or something like that. And then you have a dynamic portion, and that dynamic portion can be client side. So that piece that does need to hit your API or something like that, you're no longer doing that dynamic portion through, you know, postbacks and all of that type of stuff. You are running the dynamic portion on the client, and the client is doing a lot of work on that side. And then you just serve your API.
Right. Yeah. I think I'm referencing more of these super new frameworks like Remix and Blitz, oh, sure, where they've literally flipped the model to be like, look, everything's just server side rendered now. Like, that's just what we do. It's interesting to see those kind of things start to get some action out there when we intentionally moved around it. But yeah, you're right. It's not the same when you're generating static sites where part of the page is statically generated. You're offloading that compute to build time, which is nice. And then the client is still doing things. I think that that's the part where the dynamic piece comes in here, is that you haven't removed any processing from the client. You've just hidden it. It's almost like a UX improvement, because when your site is hit and it's a statically generated site that's doing React, right? Let's just use that as the example. The content comes back, it's displayed immediately, but React still runs and rehydrates. So it's doing all the work, if not a little bit more, to hook all of its events up, to create the virtual DOM, all that stuff is happening and then getting in sync with whatever content was pre-rendered. So we're not getting rid of any compute on the client most of the time.
I mean, yeah, I'd say that's all this stuff is happening because developers like to keep things interesting and move things forward. You know, there's always a way to eke out that little bit of extra performance or something like that. And I'd say most developers kind of are charging ahead trying to make that happen.
Yeah. What do you call that? You always mention this premature
optimization.
Yeah, I love that one. Developers love premature optimizations. I've seen so many people come in and like architect their site so that it could get as much traffic as Facebook. And I'm like, that's premature. Yeah. You have zero traffic now.
I have plenty of sites that I've written in the past that, you know, you have this idea in mind and you want to be planet scale at the beginning or even galaxy right. scale.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you might get 100 visitors a month for years.
And it's crazy. As developers, we're nuts. Like we always go to like worst case scenario and then code for it.
Yeah.
It's funny.
But this stuff, this is a cool convergence in my mind that's happened on the web. Like when I got into developing on the web, I remember like learning about Jekyll and similar static site generators and how you could put those, you use those to generate your site and then put that on a CDN. And it would just be like lightning fast, like quickest initial load you could ever see. Like that's cool. But then you have the marketers, the content creators who, they're not going to write in Markdown and push it to some no, they want a CMS. Give me something with dynamism and being able to, create content on the fly like WordPress. Right. And so there's a lot of power there, but it's just slow when you're processing every request on demand. You know, so for a while, I feel like the fix has been, going back to Matt Mullenweg's comments, the fix has been, well, we'll layer on top of that page caching. So instead of the server getting hit on every run, we'll just do that every once in a while to refresh, the cache and serve up static assets. But now I feel like we've kind of converged between the two and found this middle ground where it's like we can have, these static assets available like a static site generator, but still have the dynamic content in one of a few ways, either fetch it on the client or, SSR. As we talked about in our last episode, you can do fancy things like fallback routes in Next.js where the first time it's visited, you server render it, but then after that it becomes cached, and these fancier solutions, we're kind of getting the best of both worlds, which is cool to me.
I think it's funny. There were years ago, I built a lot of sites using a single page app framework. And after a while, I got tired of building marketing sites, even my own marketing sites in single page app framework. So, one day I'm building a new site and I just decided like, hey, I need to go back to, I think it was Handlebars at the time. Like, I just want to create a Handlebars site with a little bit of JavaScript that does my, some dynamic pieces to make the site look, enriched, and give people a better experience. And then I'll just serve it from my server and I'll cache everything and it'll be fast and I'll get the SEO and I don't need to worry about it. And I built this little tool. I think I called it like Simple Site or something at the time. This is before all the Netlify and Jamstack and all that. And And yeah, I was so proud of myself at that point in time, like, hey, I'm not using a single page app. And then now fast forward a couple of years and it's like, we're back to using, or we are using single page apps. And only this time, those same single page apps are rendered on the server and rehydrated on the client side. And it's like, now you're kind of getting the best of both worlds, which is awesome to me.
Yeah, I will say I maintain a couple apps and sites. The easiest one for me to maintain consistently for a long period of time is a Handlebars app that I wrote. I never go into it, an NPM update, and have an issue. Like, it just works every time.
Every time.
It's great. Any React app I open after a few years, you're like, oh man, here we go.
Beautiful. Well, and this leads into another good point that we wanted to cover, and that is one of Matt Mellenweg's arguments is having your application only as strong as your weakest link in the chain. So one of his arguments is when you use WordPress as a monolith, there's a single source of failure. Just, is your site up? You know, is it online? Then everything's working. Otherwise, if you break things up into, you know, one service for authentication, one service for your e-commerce content, one service for your, you know, CMS, your blog content, whatever, another service for something else. Now your site is only as resilient as, you know, its weakest tool in the chain. And my view on this is that although that's true, I don't think it's an accident, you know, when sites are being architected and somebody chooses to break it up into these services, I think that's being done intentionally in most cases. You know, they're making a, doing a cost benefit analysis and deciding that, you know, the uptime that this particular service has and what it'll do for our application is worth it. So we'll use that as part of our app. And my other like rebuttal would be, you know, you can go headless and still have not very many sources of failure. You know, so if I have WordPress as my backend application, and then I use something like Gatsby or Next.js or Nux or something else as my front end, that's two things talking to each other. Like, you know, we're not talking about a large number of services here. So I think I would be very comfortable launching something like that, knowing that, you know, my uptime and the chance of failure is looking very good with that kind of setup.
Yeah, that was a weird argument for me too, in that in a monolith, you have a single point of failure. If your monolith goes down, everything's down. Whereas when you break things up, now this isn't, I'm not trying to make the case that you break things up as granular as possible. Definitely don't do that. But when you do break things up, you introduce the possibility to not have a single point of failure. Like, one of those services could go down and maybe your whole site isn't down. Only part of your site is down. For instance, if you're in a headless environment and you're doing an e-commerce site and you're using Shopify for your products and shopping cart and everything, and then you're using WordPress for your content and blog, WordPress could go down, but you could still sell products, right? That's so you have this flexibility. And in an enterprise scenario where you certainly have lots of services like a CRM, an ERP, you know, all of those things are part of your site, it's a benefit in that case, like that you're not reliant on this one single point of failure.
Yeah, I'd say you can even take it one step further with this Shopify WordPress example. WordPress could go down and your posts could still be there now. Right. I mean, you're using Jamstack, it's served through a CDN, it's hosted, it hits your WordPress True. Site, some error happens and it says, okay, I'll use the cached version instead. And you don't even necessarily have to worry about it, right? We even hit this with our developers, developers.wpengine.com site. We had an issue with our WordPress instance and we didn't realize it for a few days because, hey, the posts were showing and everything was fine. And then we go into the WordPress site and we realize, oh, this something we did has taken this down and it won't work.
Yeah, the only reason that I noticed it is because I tried to publish a new post and it didn't show up, and I logged in and saw that WP GraphQL was missing somehow.
Yeah, cool. Exactly.
Oops. I think the failing gracefully thing is so huge, you know. And as we're when you first look at headless, you know, a lot of people go straight to like, well, what's the speed and security or whatever. But probably a very underrated thing I think is being able to fail gracefully. So like, Will, you had an excellent example about, you know, what if you push something and your build failed? Okay. Keep using the old assets and give the developers time to figure out why it failed and then deploy again, like not a problem. Right. So that's a huge deal. And my mind also goes to, if someone is using your client side app and their internet connection drops out, you know, in the good old days of the web, it's like, if my internet connection is gone and I tap a link on my device, white screen, like game over. Right. But with these, you know, modern applications that have more logic built into the client, you can probably, you know, 1,000 times better user experience, right? You can, your app will still be there. If they tap this link and they're offline, you can fall back and, you know, show us a message and say, oh, you're offline right now. You want to head back or do something else or whatever, but they don't get this like white screen game over experience. They can head back to the, you know, some of the cache data that may be on their device or whatever, and they get some indication of why something isn't loading instead of just, you know, defaulting to a white screen or whatever. So I'm a big fan of those experiences.
Yeah. They also, you know, you might go to, you load up the index page of some website. The framework they're using goes and visits every link and loads up the static assets and static page from those links. Your internet goes down. Now you click one of the links and it's like your internet didn't even go down. You've visited that. And so if you do have a spotty internet connection, you can download the assets when you need them and then potentially get an experience on a website where your internet might be slow, but the website is still rendering very quickly.
And you can even take that one step forward and create a PWA cache data there so that even if you're offline, you get on a plane, you can still visit that site and pull up the data that you had already loaded. And if that site's prefetching stuff, you could even like have if it's a news site, let's say, you could have it prefetch a bunch of the latest news and then on the plane read the news. Like, there's so many options whenever you go headless. That's what's so cool about it for me. Like, whatever your problem is, whatever solution you're trying to build, there's an option for it in the headless world. You know, obviously, except for that one of the marketer having the control, we're still working on that. But as far as solving a problem with the end user experience, I just feel like the flexibility is so nice.
Yeah. And I'd say the marketer having control and all this, that's coming. We mentioned it earlier, but that's going to happen because that's a big market and it's a solution that is actively being worked on.
We're working on it. Yeah. We have a, open source framework. If you haven't checked it out, right now it's called Headless Framework. It will get a new name, but it's on the GitHub for WP Engine. Will's the primary maintainer there. We're really starting to bear down and build a team out and get that thing cranking. But that's one of the things we really want to solve is how can we give the marketer more power that they're used to having, where they could install a plugin or something and it would affect the front end site, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Another thing that's coming to mind for me, I think it'd be good to mention before our episode is done here, is component-based architectures. When you adopt this headless and Jamstack methodology, you get to leverage frameworks that use that. And in my mind, the developer experience is so much higher. You know, so if you go traditional WordPress and you build out a theme for your WordPress site, that is still, the theme API was built in the era when we thought separation of concerns meant separating files by their type. You know, so you have your PHP template files that live in one place in your project. You have your CSS, like all your SAS partials and so on, live in another place in your app. And then any JavaScript, you know, might live somewhere else in your app. And, you know, people thought your code was well organized if it was structured that way. But then later we, as an industry, decided that separating files by their type like that doesn't offer a true separation of concerns. In fact, what it does is make things hard to keep in sync. You know, if someone modifies some of the markup and they have to figure out, all right, which slash partials somewhere on the site might have been targeting these selectors that I now broke, I better go hunt around and find them all. Right. So one of the innovations, among many other things that React brought to the table, one of the innovations there was this new component-based architecture where you could have you know, your markup or your, you know, JSX that ultimately gets ends up getting rendered out. Any styles you could, you know, co-locate, whether that's a separate SAS file or even using something like a CSS in JS library, like emotion or styled components or whatever, you could have that. The styles co-located, as well as, you know, any JavaScript for interactivity or data fetching or whatever needs to happen. You can have all of those things co-located so they're very easy to manage and keep in sync and, you know, test in isolation and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's a big deal for as the demands on the web get, you know, more and more complex and people are wanting these like really snappy offline first, you know, experiences. I think having, you know, component-based architecture is underrated because it allows you to build those and maintain your app. If you have a large team, you know, and everyone's working on things in parallel, it's much easier for things to get out of sync. If you have, you know, this backlog of, you know, 100 SAS partials that target markup, and like if one person forgets to, you know, edit both the styles and the JavaScript and the whatever to keep things in sync, now that's just tech debt that accumulates, you know. So moving from that to a component-based architecture is a big deal for maintainability and understanding how your code works, I think.
Yeah, I think there's been a similar shift on the back end in APIs where, you know, like in a traditional MVC application, you might have all your models in one place, all your controllers in one place, your views in another place. And now in recent years, maybe the last 10 years or so, we've seen a shift towards more component-based architectures where, you know, all of your user stuff is in one area and all of your post stuff is in another area and all of your billing is in another area. And it's taken even further with microservices, not to say that that's the way you need to go, but making things more componentized so that you can ship them around where they need to go, easily distributed between different applications or things like that, rather than having to understand, okay, this file here goes with this file that might be way over here and this other set of files and things like that.
Yeah, to me, the component-based architecture is critical to modern development. And the reason for that is, like, I'm sure that a lot of the people listening to us work at agencies where in the past you've started every site with some starter theme on WordPress, like if you're doing generic WordPress or traditional WordPress, and you get this theme, you start with that, and then you modify it, and that becomes the client site. If that theme changes, there's no way to get downstream updates to that theme. Well, what these component-based architectures allow you to do is, as an agency, you can share components between all of your client sites. And if you find a bug, let's say, in a drawer component that you've created or a slider, you literally update that component and then push it out to all of the sites that your clients have, rather than saying, oh, crap, there was a problem in that theme that we need to go fix. And now we got to go to each client site, make that same code change to all of them. You know, the component-based architecture in my mind is, yes, it's nice that you get this like organization of your components, but the reuse of the components across projects is where it really shines. And for an agency, you can improve your efficiency. And, you know, it's all about margins there. Like, how fast can you get this thing done with this little effort? You know, whenever you can add that piece into your agency workflow, you can really improve margins and provide better experiences long term for your clients as well. Those downstream changes are huge. And that's something that we're really, really focused on with our headless framework, is making sure that when we create themes in the headless world, that they don't work like themes in the WordPress world, where those themes can get downstream changes from the theme developer. So if you buy a theme or you download a theme or whatever, you know, if that developer adds functionality or fixes bugs, there needs to be a way for you to pull that down. And we're going to be able to do that because of the architecture that of the front end, like the way that it's gone with these component-based architectures. So I'm super pumped about the ability for us to do that in the future with headless WordPress.
I would say for traditional WordPress sites, the closest you could get to that would be a parent theme. You know, so this is fairly common in the agency world and freelance world as well, where you have a parent theme that you're comfortable with and you build a child theme on top of it. And as you're describing, if a bug is discovered or whatever in the parent theme, you could update, you know, you could download
that's
that
how Genesis from, works.
Right. Yeah. Genesis and other frameworks. You could, you know, of course, you know, install that on your client site, test it out and make sure everything still works and then get those changes later on. But yeah, what I'm hearing from you is, you know, that would be, it goes beyond that. You know, you could, for your agency, you could have a standard, you know, drawer component to your example, whatever that you would live. So that would be akin to some of your individual components in the child theme now. Even those can be updated, you know, in the future, and then affect sites you had built in the past to fix a certain bug or whatever.
Yeah, another good example would be like an SEO component. Like Will has an SEO component that he created that pulls stuff from Yoast. Now let's say that Google introduces some new thing into the JSON schema. You can go update that component, have it pull the data out, and just work across all the sites without having to go mess with SEO, you know, for every site that you've written over the last however long you're maintaining these things. So there's so many possibilities once you think about it in the component-based architecture. All right, let's see. What have we not hit here on the headless WordPress side?
One I can think of is build times. So that was one of the other criticisms. So if you're going with the pure, you know, the original definition of the Jamstack architecture, that was one criticism is that Matt made. He compares it to the old days of movable type, an old system where you had to generate a build of your whole site and people got fed up waiting for the build. You know, some of his comments in the articles, you know, it relate. He looks at Jamstack and says it feels like it harkens back to those days of movable type and waiting so long for builds. And I would say at this stage, like that's also a valid criticism. If you're deploying a site for the first time, you know, waiting for it to build out the pages, and if you don't have something like Gatsby's incremental builds that we talked about in our previous episode, if that doesn't exist, you'll end up having to rebuild the whole site on every deploy, which I think is a valid, you know, criticism, but it's not an insurmountable problem. You know, Gatsby does have their own solution to that. In the WordPress world, there's a WP Gatsby plugin that actually registers its own post type, and its job is to keep track of all of the changes that occurred in WordPress since the last time you deployed. So then when a new, you know, build is triggered in Gatsby, it can phone home, so to speak, and check to see what changes were made since the last build and only rebuild certain pages, you know? So I think even that problem is going away in the headless world, but it still exists. If you don't have a solution like that, you know, for doing incremental builds, then I would say that's a valid, you know, criticism.
Yeah, this is the reason I use Next, honestly. Like, I don't want to do this upfront build. I just want that thing to happen at the time it's hit. Also, the other thing that you don't think about with Gatsby, yes, if data changes, you only have to generate the page for that, whatever that data is related to. But if you go and make a code change to the single page template, it's got to regenerate every single page at that point. So I could go change like anything. I could add a space somewhere on the single page template. Now I'm generating thousands of static pages.
If your header changes by one pixel.
Yeah. You're like, right. The designer comes back and he's like, you missed.
Yeah, so I think I think Next has solved this with the fallback, right? They generated on demand, and everyone after the first person who visits is going to get a generated static site or static page, and even then, building a single page is not the issue, right? And Matt, I don't think Matt Mullenweg was mentioning like just building one page is a problem. It's building the whole site. So like Matt said, if you change the single page template, then you have to rebuild all the posts for your site or all the pages for your site, whichever one it is. And with Next, even with the fallback, it's like that one person, it's not like they have to wait hours to get the page. They wait a couple, maybe a second, and they get their page, and then everyone else gets a static cached page.
Plus one for Next.
And Next, you know, going back to my comments about like convergence or whatever, I would say Next.js feels like that to me. It's like Next.js decided, you know, we're going to be one of the first ones to the table to offer this, you know, solid maintained framework for doing server-side rendering in React. You know, but then they saw the success I think that Gatsby and others were having and decided, you know what, we can do static and embrace this pure Jamstack pre-rendering everything model. We can do all of that on top of the SSR that we already do. So what you end up with is a convergence of the two, you know, where you, if you have pages that you want to pre-render 100% of the time, you can do that. But as you guys are describing, you could also have pure SSR or pages that are, you know, static with a fallback if the static hasn't been generated yet and so on. That seems to be a really nice compromise, you know, where you get to make the choice.
Yeah. For example, the developer site, developers.wpengine.com is a Next site. And we, for our post, for our blog, we are pre-rendering at build time. I think the first handful of posts, I don't know how many it is exactly, but we pre-render the first handful and the rest are fallback. So we don't say, hey, go and render every post, but we do want the first couple because they may be getting hit more often.
Yeah, we want to pre-render the ones that are linked from the homepage, right? And then the rest can fall back. That way, when you hit the site, you know you're going to get experience moving around. And then the first time some of those are hit, it might render. But you're talking about very fast. Even if it has to server-side render, we're talking about nearly imperceptible to the user just because it's making an API call and pulling back a little bit of data and rendering it. It's just not having to do that much. All right. Yeah, one thing I wanted to bring up too was, you know, going back to the CDN discussion, actually, always back to the CDN. But, you know, Mullenweg brought up the point that, yeah, you can cache this stuff around the globe out of traditional WordPress, but he's really only talking about a media site where that becomes really valuable. On an e-com site or, you know, anywhere where you have lots of changes happening and you need to have those updates or anything that's dynamic, like truly dynamic, you don't have that ability anymore. So it's really difficult to scale a monolith like WordPress whenever you are dealing with a truly dynamic site like an e-com site. And I think that's why you've seen Shopify take off the way it has, is that they've solved that scalability problem on the e-com side by having a different architecture. And now with Headless, we can do that as well. So that's one thing that wasn't really, I didn't feel like it was brought up that well in the discussion, but it's an important thing to think about. So if your site is highly dynamic, you know, Headless is going to be even more valuable to you. All right. Well, I guess I think we've covered like most of the topics. You guys have anything else that you want to bring up about when to choose
Headless? I have one more, and it's not a technical one. This one is related to if you are a developer yourself, you're choosing which of these methodologies to use to build sites. I think you would be wise to think about like which of these is going to make me very marketable. You know, which of these skills are in demand, you know, because if you're, in my view, if you're building traditional WordPress sites, you'll have no shortage of work. There are lots of WordPress sites out there and people need them maintained and so on. But I think you would be less marketable for getting newer jobs in the future if you only ever focus on those. You know, if I'm an employer coming to somebody and saying, you know, I would ask them, yeah, do you have experience with new front-end technologies, like any of the recent JavaScript frameworks that are out there, or working with the NPM ecosystem, you know, in general, you know, to do like offline first applications or single page apps or whatever. Have you done that stuff? You know, and their answer would probably, well, not really. I'm used to the WordPress's theme API and sprinkling in a little, you know, jQuery or vanilla JavaScript. I really am not familiar with that stuff. I think you would make yourself less marketable. Or if you're, a backend developer, if you've only ever done backend work on traditional WordPress sites, and then somebody says, hey, we need to be able to pull out, you know, we need something that's just pure data, and we need to be able to pull that out to use in some of our mobile apps. Do you have any experience with, you know, REST API endpoints or with using GraphQL so that we could serve up that data. Again, if your answer is not really, I've only ever, you know, built monolithic WordPress sites where the data is used, you know, on the site itself and never anywhere externally, I think you would be limiting yourself again. So in my mind, like that's beyond just the technical implications that may be there. I think that's an important one to consider as well, is, you know, what tech is in demand and would you be able to leverage it, you know, if you yourself are a software developer.
Yeah. One thing I'll point out there is WordPress is definitely not going away anytime soon. So I don't know that if you're a WordPress developer now, you necessarily need to rush into the new technologies. WordPress is still 40% of the web. You're going to have plenty of gainful employment for years to come. I'd also say some things tend to, you know, in the development world, concepts and even languages tend to come back around. Like if you somehow got into COBOL, there are plenty of job opportunities for you now to go write COBOL. So while I think that the general trend is, you know, new languages and new technologies start to overtake the current technologies. And that's definitely true as a maybe more generalization, but that's not to say that WordPress is just going to die. And, you know, in 10 years, you're not going to find anyone needing a WordPress developer. It's going to be around for a long time.
Maybe even more demand in the future.
Yeah, we just don't know right now.
I mean, you got a lot of WordPress code out there that's got to be maintained. And if developers aren't hot in learning that technology, there's only going to be more demand for people to work on that. I mean, I've seen that happen in the mainframe world for sure. You know, on the same vein of like developers, you know, increasing their marketable skills, I also think that it's just enjoyable to code in this environment. Like the developer experience is nice. I go in, I make a change to my SAS or my HTML or JSX or whatever. I save that file and I immediately just see the update on the screen as I'm doing it. Like that's a fun iterative development cycle that I like to be in. Whereas in a traditional one, you got to go refresh the page and save stuff. So I do think that it's just fun to code in this way. Like, there's a lot of tooling. There's a lot of support. And I see this when I talk to clients and customers of ours who are learning it. They're like, they talk about how much they really love getting into React and doing the front stuff, like the front end stuff. They light up when they talk about it. Like it's just a fun ecosystem to be a part of, I think. And that means something too. Like this is your job. You're working, you're doing this all the time. Like you want to enjoy it. And that's why I could. Cool. Well, I think that we hit most of what we wanted to talk about. If not, there's more episodes to come every week. So who knows what we'll be talking about next week, but join us for our live coding. Follow us on Twitter. You can find all of us, Matt_Landers, W. Johnstowe, Kellen Mace on Twitter. Get on our Discord channel. Check out our content on developers.wpengine.com. And obviously show up to our live coding sessions on Fridays at 1. And you can heckle me like Fran does. Enjoy.
Yeah, shout out to Fran. He's the only one who's made it this far. So, Fran, you can go follow us on Twitter.
What's up, Fran? I'm sure you got another picture of me for Slack later. Looking forward to that. All right, enough inside jokes. Go out there, build some headless WordPress sites, and happy coding. Thank you.